Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this session, Mitigating the Risk of Errors You Can't Afford to Make. My name's Nicolette Rubenstein. I'm very excited to be chairing today's session. It's yet another exciting concurrent session that we've got here, and it's exciting for me because Simone has written an excellent and very thought-provoking book called Hoot, so one of our very own, having written a book on risk management. A little bit about Simone. She's an actuary, experienced risk and compliance leader with over 25 years of experience across multiple geographies. She's a graduate of AICD. And, you know, when you read the book, you realize what makes her work special is her passion for the intersection between behavioral science and risk. And she really brings a human lens to risk. She's bought some copies of the book as well that you're welcome to take with you when you leave. I think she will offer that later. And she's still actually gathering feedback on the book as well. In fact, I know there's a couple of people. I can see one already who's given some feedback. So the format of today, Simone's going to present for about half an hour, and then we've got time for questions. You can submit the questions via the app, or we'll do the via the mic in the room. So with that, please join me in welcoming Simone to the stage.
There. Okay. Well, thank you, Nicolette, and guys, thank you so much for joining me today. This is actually quite an exciting day for me because it's the first time I'm presenting on this book that I've been writing. And anyone who knows me actually knows, I think Greg can attest to it, having worked for him, that I am probably the last person that you would expect to be writing a book. I can tell you that, you know, the movies make writing books very glamorous. And so I had an expectation that I was going to sit down, I was going to flow, I was going to write this book, just one version, and then I was going to have a polished book and, you know, some champagne and some celebrating. And I think that Nicolette can tell you, and a few people, other people in this room who've written a book can tell you, it is nothing like that. It became a labor of love. It felt like a labor of 1,000 edits. But it did end up being on a topic that I think is fascinating and very interesting, and I really do believe is fundamental to running good businesses. And I also think it's fundamental to actually, you know, being in your personal life, making good decisions. So thank you for joining me today. I'm going to actually just take us on a very abbreviated journey of what's in the book and the themes of the book. I hope you guys find it as interesting as I have. So Hoot, as you might have noticed, is the title of the book. We're going to get into why it's named that. I can tell you now it's not an acronym. There is a reason for it. What the story really is about, if I just give you a quick synopsis, is about a missing part of risk management that I found. It's where we ignore the actual degree that biases put on the decisions we're making. So we're making errors in our corporate organizations, and we're not even realizing that bias is part of the problem. So it actually becomes particularly important when it comes to those infrequent decisions, those really big decisions that are being made in organizations, which can end up having spectacular failures for organizations, or it ends up being, you know, a death by 1,000 cuts, you know, some really bad decisions, enough of them, and, you know, organizations fail that way. So let's jump in. So, you know, how many of you have ever wondered, you know, with all the improvements that we're making in organizations, you know, we've been improving governance and risk management and data, artificial intelligence, all of these things, you know, why are we still seeing so many failures in organizations? You know, and these failures are impacting organizations in terms of, you know, these strategies that never get off the ground, or it ends up, you know, with these very expensive initiatives that fizzle out. We're ending up with, you know, lost revenue. We're ending up with reputational hits. You know, these mistakes made me question whether we're really addressing all of the key risks in our organizations, or at best, are we just implementing what the regulator has been telling us to do, in which case are we doing risk management or are we actually doing compliance? So this a few years ago, with my risk management lens on, I started really wrestling with this question. And I went on a journey to explore what could be missing. And I found, I think we actually have a blind spot. It's a blind spot that I don't think our risk registers and our reporting is actually seeing. You know, I couldn't find the answers in the textbooks. And so what I rather did is I decided to turn to public case studies. These are real world examples of where organizations have failed. We're talking about organizations like Barings Bank, FTX, you know, building the Sydney Opera House, Nokia, BlackBerry. You can probably name many of them. There were actually over 50 by the time I was done. With all of them, I was doing a lot of reading. I was doing a lot of government reports, reading books. I was looking at business school case studies. I read some really salacious media articles about it. And from that, I started to see what I think is the blind spot. It's something that's missing from our frameworks, something that I've never seen in any risk register in an organization. You see, most of us believe with the right information, people make the right decision. But I stumbled into a world that told me otherwise. We assume that smart people make rational decisions, but they don't, not often enough. And that irrationality, that's the blind spot for many organizations, and that's the thing that they haven't addressed. And it falls into the world of behavioral science. So, to bring you into this world, I share with you a crash course in the book, and we'll quickly go through it now, because you need to actually understand how we think to understand what's really missing and how we address it. Right, so before we jump into it, in this room, I'd like to know, how many of you have read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow? From cover to cover. Yeah. And how about, okay, just reading a little bit of it, because it's a pretty hard read, isn't it? Yeah. But it actually was my first clue in what was really missing. To make sure we're all on the same page, I'm going to give you a very quick summary. So what Daniel Kahneman says is that we've got two basically modes of thinking. And he very unimaginatively, or probably good for actuaries because we like numbers, called it System 1 and System 2. So let's start with System 1. This is your fast-thinking brain. It's intuitive, it's automatic, and it's effortless. It's what you use when you slam on brakes when a ball comes into the road. It's always on, and you can't control it. Now, when it comes to System 2, this is your slow-thinking brain. It's analytical, it's logical, it's deliberate. It's what you use when you write a business case or when you're looking for that error that you made in your model. You know, System 2 is the part we like to believe is running the show. It's our rational selves. But there's a problem. You see, System 2 is actually quite expensive in terms of effort and attention. So it actually only shows up when it has to. Most of the time, we're running on System 1. We rely on it because it's fast and it's efficient. And for the most part, it actually works brilliantly. But it also comes with a trade-off. You see, to move quickly, System 1 has to use shortcuts, which are called heuristics. Now, these heuristics simplify complex problems so that we can act fast. But that can also lead us to make predictable mistakes, which are called cognitive biases. And I apologize for anyone who already knows that, but that's about the summary we have. But the kicker is that we aren't even aware that our thinking is making these mistakes. And even if we're told about it and we're trained on biases, we find it incredibly hard to identify it within ourselves. Over the years, there's been many cognitive biases that have been identified. In fact, in 2021, the World Economic Forum identified over 180. I'm sure by now there's more. But if we go back to thinking fast and slow, I just want to call out the limitation that's in that book, which is, and with any sociology book, which is that they keep the underlying, you know, constant, the underlying environment constant, and they only vary the one thing that they're testing, and then they draw conclusions. But in real life case studies, it's really difficult to do that. In fact, it's impossible to do that because you have variability in everything. You have variability, you know, everything's changing and, you know, situations are multifaceted and, you know, we have, unprecedented situations. Very hard to run, you know, tests like that. But we need to explore rather how those decisions are being made in some of those most complex, high pressure and unexpected situations. So what I was curious about is could we overlay those biases with those real world organizational failures? And that's what I did in my book. So today I'm just going to focus on a couple of case studies, and I'll go straight into just a couple of ways that you can manage the risk, because there's no point in just talking about what they are. You know, that's very theoretical. We actually need to talk about what to do about it. So I'm going to use a very apt analogy from the first case study. Strap in. Now, the book starts with two strangers, and they meet on a flight. And that aeroplane that they're on happens to be a Boeing. And the protagonist of the book shares a story of a couple of recent Boeing crashes and how luck had nothing to do with those tragedies. Wow. Okay, better not get too close. So this over here behind us is the Boeing factory in Everett, Washington. It's near Seattle. It's actually the largest building on Earth by volume. It's 100 acres. And it houses over 30,000 workers, so it's pretty enormous. It was constructed in the 1960s to build the Boeing model, the 747, which was the first jumbo jet, which is actually 2.5 times bigger than the current aircraft at that time. But the model before that was called the 737, and it was introduced in 1967, and it would go on to become the best-selling jet ever made. Now, fast forward more than 40 years to 2011. American Airlines was one of Boeing's biggest customers. They were threatening to move their fleet from Boeing, which is American, to Airbus, their biggest competitor, which is European. Now, this was an enormous threat for Boeing. And so to compete, they rushed at developing a new model so that they could compete with Airbus. Now, Airbus was actually, the new Airbuses were particularly competitive because they were fuel efficient. And this was in a rising fuel cost situation. So they needed to make their new version more fuel economic. So they did that, but they did it by updating the old 737. And they named the new aircraft the 737 MAX. Part of the decision to upgrade an existing model was because then they could treat it as an amendment to their original FAA certification. Now, the FAA is the aviation regulator in the U.S., so they wouldn't have to go through a whole new process, and we all know how regulation can take a really long time when you're, for example, you know, getting a new life insurer, for example. So they were very keen on this idea of it, you know, expediting it and being able to get the aircraft flying as quick as they could. It also meant then that they could, you know, get the competition with Airbus then and get it up in the sky. It also meant for the airlines, which are their clients, that they could use the same spare parts, which was a bonus, and very importantly, that they wouldn't have to put their pilots through training again. They could actually just, use the same training. And training is actually very expensive when it comes to airlines because they have to take the pilots off, you know, active flights and put them in simulators. So obviously treating it as an amendment, though, meant that what they'd have to do is actually keep it pretty similar to the current model. But the 737, to make it more fuel efficient, had to have new engines. And the new engines they put in were 40% wider and they were twice as heavy. Now, I'm no aeronautical engineer, but that meant that they had to make the aircraft wider and the wingspan longer, and that then changed the center of gravity of the aircraft, and it actually made it more likely to stall in certain circumstances. I think you all know where this is going, and I'm sure a lot of you know the story, but bear with me. Okay, now, this is where I start explaining to you how aircrafts fly. Strap in for this one. I had to get my 17-year-old son to explain it to me, and it's very limited, but I'll give you the key points, okay? I'm going to be using this Boeing right here. Now, it's a 787, but let's pretend it's a 737, and full disclosure, when I bought it, I thought it was much bigger, but this arrived, and so this is what we're using. Okay, so here we go. So the reason for the stall risk has to do with how airflow is going over the wing. So an airplane's flying, and air is going over it. What is happening is, the key point to know is that the angle of the wings creates a flow of air, which causes different levels of pressure below and above the wings. So it's flying, the air is coming over it, and there's different pressure above and below the wings. Okay, so far, so good. Now, As the angle's getting steeper, initially it's actually a really good thing because it helps it go faster. But if it gets too steep, what ends up happening is that airflow breaks and then it can't actually help the airplane fly anymore. And I guess at the extreme, you never see an airplane flying like this because there's nothing keeping it in the air. It would stall. So basically you have an aircraft and it needs to be able to stay at a certain, the nose needs to stay at a certain elevation. Otherwise it stalls. Now, you know, engineers or aeronautical engineers are pretty clever. And so what they've done is they've got two sensors at the front of an aeroplane that are monitoring for that. So they're looking at the angle between the plane's wings and the oncoming airflow. They're called the angle of attack or the AOA sensors. Now, I'm not going to show you on this because no one will see it, but they're right there or much easier to see over there. Okay, so to prevent a stall, these Boeing engineers have developed a new software and they called it the Maneuvering Characteristic Augmentation System, which is such a mouthful, it's called MCAS for short. It's what it automatically does is it lowers the plane's nose if an AOA sensor detects that the aircraft's angle is too high. So what it's meant to do is, and here's my demonstration, it's flying, it comes a little bit up, and then it just corrects it and it carries on flying. All right, so it's automatic. Pilots don't do anything about it. Okay. But now while there are two AOA sensors on the 737 MAX, the MCAS activated if either sensor said there was an issue. And there was no consensus needed between those two sensors, which is bad decision number one. Remember that those airlines, they liked the fact that the 737 didn't need their pilots to have training. But bad decision number two was when Boeing decided that this MCAS system was a modification to the aircraft and so didn't train any of the pilots on it. Okay. That's bad decision number two. So you can see where this is going for those of you who don't know the story. On the 29th of October, 2018, Lion Air Flight 610, a 737 MAX, took off from Jakarta in good weather with 189 passengers and crew on board. 12 minutes later, it crashed. Investigations found that it dove sharply 22 times in those 12 minutes. The investigation revealed that one of those AOA sensors had malfunctioned and caused the MCAS to trigger, pushing the nose down 22 times. Pilots lost the battle with a system they didn't even know was on the aircraft they were flying. Boeing later conceded that it assumed that the pilots would know how to correct this issue if the MCAS malfunctioned. And what they then did is they released information on the MCAS and they also detailed what pilots should do if, you know, this happened again. But still, there was no training. And then, on the 9th of March, 2019, a few months later, Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, another Boeing 737, took off from Addis Ababa. And 6 minutes later crashed, killing 157 people on board. The pilots knew this time that the MCAS was on board, but the things that they were told to do to turn it off failed. And so they ended up crashing too. At this stage, Boeing had delivered more than 300 models of the 737 MAX worldwide. With 346 people dead, Boeing was still maintaining that their aircraft was safe. Aviation regulators across the world grounded the 737 MAX, and it took 20 months before the FAA agreed that the 737 MAX could come back into service, which cost, as you can imagine, Boeing significantly, both in terms of their reputation and financially. Look, you could say it was bad luck that a sensor fails, but the luck had nothing to do with the fact that it was only relying on one sensor with no redundancy, nor was luck involved when it came to the fact that the pilots weren't trained on it. With all these case studies, there's always going to be multiple reasons for failure. There's never one reason why anything fails, but poor decision-making most certainly was part of the problem. In fact, when the CEO and the chairman of Boeing testified at the U.S. Congress hearing, he said, and I quote, "If we knew everything back then that we know now, we would have made a different decision." It's kind of curious, though, why they don't mention why. Why did they make that decision? I believe that it's because one of the reasons is because of bias, and bias was contributing to those poor decisions. With hindsight, let's look at some of those biases that helped explain those decisions. So the first one to call out is confirmation bias. That's where you're selectively choosing evidence to use, the evidence that you want to use, and you're actually ignoring other evidence. And remember, you're not doing this maliciously. You're actually just subconsciously doing it. It's particularly a dangerous cognitive bias because it validates our views and it closes our mind to the fact that we may be wrong. You know, warning signs are getting ignored, not because we're being malicious, but because of this bias. In the case of Boeing, they seem to favor data that supported the idea that the AMCAS was just a minor change. Another bias that might have played into this bad decision was something called overconfidence, or we could call it hubris too. That's where you have an excessive confidence in one's own ability. It often presents in organizations that have been incredibly successful. Now, Boeing was one of the top manufacturers of aircraft, so it was definitely incredibly successful. And it was also had a stellar reputation, both for being super clever and for being safe. And also remember that they had been very successful in the past when they tweaked, you know, existing models instead of building new ones. So there definitely could have been some hubris there. So they made it being excessively confident when they just assumed that pilots would know what to do if the MCAS malfunctioned. Now, not to say that self-confidence isn't fundamental to good leadership and organizational success. It is. It helps leaders develop creative and ambitious visions, and it also generates excitement and enthusiasm. The problem is when that self-belief becomes excessive, and then it can create negative unintended consequences. Another bias that you might find happened here is something called anchoring. This is where we anchor our judgment to something that has happened in the past, information that's happened in the past, meaning that we're ignoring other information. You know, many businesses tend to anchor to things like, you know, ideas and products and remuneration structures and operating models. And I've even seen some organizations anchor to how they run meetings. So anchoring happens quite often. It narrows your thinking and it closes your mind to the idea that there might be something else, a better option. Boeing may have anchored to the idea that they were making minor changes to the aircraft and so didn't need to train those pilots. They also probably anchor to the strategy of tweaking models. Or another bias that comes in is optimism. So now this is where you genuinely, we all know what optimism is, where, you know, we get overly happy with something. But it's generally a great quality because optimistic people are usually happier, healthier, and successful. In organizations, we all want to actually follow optimistic leaders. It generates energy. But in some circumstances, optimism can lead to errors. It can cause people to make decisions on an ideal view of the future. Yeah, us actuaries probably call it, you know, best case scenario. It's a world in our minds that really doesn't exist where everything goes to plan and where you know, we don't even realize that we're being overly optimistic about it. Nothing goes wrong. Actually, optimism is quite good in some roles. And there's a really good book, if anyone's read, called How Big Things Get Done. And they use this great analogy, which is very apt for the Boeing case study. They say you want the flight attendant, not the pilot, to be optimistic. What you need from your pilot and must insist on is hard-nosed analysis and that they see the reality as clearly as possible. So Boeing might have had that optimism too because they possibly believed the MCAS wouldn't malfunction or that pilots would just work out what to do about it. And we don't actually know exactly what biases came into play here, but we do know that they contributed to a poor decision being made and some very fatal outcomes. Okay, I hope you're still with me here, and we're all experts now on Boeing 737 MAX. I'm just going to run through one more case study, and I'm going to get some water first. While you can all read the slide on what we're talking about, and I think we all know what it is. Okay, so this is obviously the Deepwater Horizon disaster, which many of you might already know the details of. But for those of you that don't want to read, there was a 400-page report that was done for the U.S. president. Or for those who haven't watched the really good movie by Mark Wahlberg, I'll kind of set the scene for us. So this is the area here that we're talking about. It's about 80 kilometers off the coast of Louisiana in the Gulf of Mexico. Or lately, some people have been calling it the Gulf of America, but let's just stay with the Gulf of Mexico for now. BP had paid for a lease to drill a seabed plot here called the Macondo site. Now, I'll be honest, I really did try go on Amazon and find you a toy of a drill, of a deep water drill and an oil rig, but apparently children don't like to play with such things. So just going to have to imagine this and I'll try use my hands. So this particular site that they had leased was 1.6 kilometers under the water. And then they were drilling 4 kilometers under that to get a hydrocarbon reserve. Okay. Now, as you can imagine, you know, drilling deep water wells is very complicated and complex, and it requires many stages. One of the stages is that you need a very expensive rig, which does the digging, and then it closes it with a cement plug, and then it goes off, and then you get a cheaper rig to come in, and that's the thing that actually extracts the oil and gas. So this Macondo site was at the stage. Well, this project was at the stage where the expensive rig was digging when in January 2010, Hurricane Ida hit and damaged the rig. And they had to replace it, and they replaced it with a rig called the Deepwater Horizon. Now, if we fast forward a few months, on the 20th of April, the Deepwater Horizon rig was preparing to temporarily abandon this well by running some of the tests needed to check that there were no leaks. As you can imagine, leaks are a bad thing when it comes to deepwater wells. There were 126 people on board. Let me show you the Deepwater Horizon. There it is. Very exciting. There were 126 people on board at the time, the 20th of April. When a blowout occurred. Now, a blowout is where oil or gas surges uncontrollably from the formations under the seabed, and it goes into the ocean and into the environment. And the blowout caused an explosion on the rig. 11 people died. Many people got seriously injured. And it turned into the worst environmental oil spill in U.S. history. It took 87 days for them to be able to plug that oil spill. And by that stage, 4 million barrels of oil had uncontrollably spilt into the Gulf of Mexico. For those who want to do the maths, each of those barrels is 150 liters. BP ultimately ended up paying $65 billion, US dollars that is, in compensation, and experienced a dramatic drop in their stock price, as well as, you can imagine, really reputational damage. The investigations found that and concluded that the disaster at the Macondo well was preventable. And they called out multiple root causes. Again, the point, it's never one thing. Multiple things cause these failures. But a key thing they called out and it kept recurring was that they missed warning signs. But you don't see anything in any of the analysis about why. Why did they miss those warning signs? And as you will already know, I think bias. I think bias played a reason into why they missed those warning signs and why those really, you know, fatal decisions were made. Let me illustrate with a critical step in the story of the Deepwater Horizon. Now, as we said, before you can abandon a well, you need to do some testing. So they were doing at this point a test called the negative pressure test. This was actually the only test they were doing to make sure that the that cement plug that they had was, you know, was actually working, was actually sealing stuff. So what exactly is the negative pressure test? And I'm going to be totally honest with you. I got ChatGPT to help me explain this. Well, here's the basics according to ChatGPT. When drilling, oil and gas are sitting under immense pressure deep underground. And as soon as you drill into them, that pressure wants to surge up the well, right? But to hold it back, so you've got all this pressure and, you know, all this oil and gas that's just wanting to come out. And to hold it all back, you put into the well what's called drilling fluid, and they actually call it mud. And that actually causes a balance. So the pressure from, you know, under the formation and the pressure from the well, you end up with a balance and you don't have a blowout. Now, when you actually abandon a well, you actually have to take the mud out. So you have to, and you're replacing it with the seawater, which has got less pressure. So one of the tests you have to do is to make sure that, the, you know, there's, that, that plug is holding it back. And that there's no, oil that's going to leak through. So, you know, that's what they really did. They simulated, and the way they do it is by removing the mud, and they just basically see what happens. You know, if the well stays quiet, it means there's a barrier, including the cement, the well, and the barrier, and they're doing their job. But if pressure builds up or fluid starts flowing, it's a warning sign. Something's leaking. And on the Deepwater Horizon, that warning sign appeared. During the test, pressure built up in that well 3 times. But instead of treating that result as a red flag, what did the Deepwater Horizon guys do, the BP well site leaders? They decided to come up with an explanation for why they were seeing it, and they decided to rather run the test on another pipe called the kill line, which actually sits next to the well. And that test was successful, the one on the kill line, and they decided to ignore the failed test and didn't decide to reconcile, you know, the differences and, you know, why they were seeing differences. And that decision would prove tragic, as we've just discussed. So again, I think we can all agree that was a confirmation bias, although if anyone disagrees, please shout. I think they were ignoring data that was going against what they wanted to believe. They found data that they could use to, you know, validate what they did believe. You know, some people actually sometimes demand very little in the way of compelling evidence to drive them to a conclusion that they want to believe in. We don't actually realize that we're picking information, you know, and we're ignoring other information to, you know, validate what we want to. Right, so in organizations, we often acknowledge the importance of data and we acknowledge the risk of having inconsistent data. I would bet that every single one of your organizations has that on your risk register. But where are we seeing or considering the risk of ignoring or selectively choosing data when making decisions? So now we get to what we do about it, okay? Because all of that was just the theory and some interesting stories and some tragic stories. But thankfully, most organizational failures don't lead to tragic losses. You don't have losses of life and you don't thankfully often have those environmental catastrophes. But that doesn't mean that they don't have significant consequences, because poor decisions caused by bias can cost organizations. And they can, you know, damage reputations, derail strategies. They can, you know, erode trust. How do we mitigate the risk of bias impacting those big decisions? You know, how do we guard against something that we actually can't identify? And I came up with the answer, what I think is the answer, and I called it HOOT. Okay. Now, imagine you're driving your car. You're driving down a road, you know, well, you're listening to music, and then you hear, that sound snaps you out of your system one thinking, and it makes you question if there's any danger you haven't seen. Instinctively, what are you going to do? You're going to look around. You're going to check your mirrors. You know, you might even at one point stop, check your tires, check your warning lights. You don't even know if that car is actually hooted at you, but you're going to really pause, stop, and reassess the situation. Now, that hoot is the first step. And that's the thing that creates the pause and triggers system two thinking. And then you're using those tools and techniques to help you reassess the situation. I think that we can do that in organizations too. We can use the same concept to mitigate biases in organizations. We can bring the concept of a hoot to create a pause and turn on our system two thinking. And then you can use some tools and techniques to de-bias those decisions. So what does that look like in an organization? Well, it's not running around with this sound, although that might be fun. We might get in trouble, though, with HR, but who knows? But it's actually really metaphorical is what I'm really thinking. It might be as simple as just giving people permission. You know, you give them permission and you encourage them, anyone at the table, to hoot when it comes to those more pivotal decisions. Remember, you're seeing bias in others that they can't see, so you're helping each other. I also believe that what gets measured gets done. And so I really think it's important to put those details in reporting somewhere. So you have pivotal decisions, you do a hoot, and you're reporting on it. You're explaining, you know, what the hoot was. It also really helps in terms of understanding the risk. Might not change the decision, but it will really give you a good understanding of that decision and the risks that come with it. But let me just quickly give you a warning here. Over-hooting actually diminishes and dulls the impact. You know, anyone who's been to Hanoi will know that that you've experienced this, where everyone is hooting all the time, so you end up ignoring it, and you know, and sometimes you actually, or I did, get a bit irritated with it. So it's really cautionary. You know, it's not meant to slow down the business, it's not meant to damage collaboration, and it's not an excuse not to make a decision. The hoot should be used sparingly and respectfully. It should be used only to warn others in decision-making process that they may unknowingly, remember it's always unknowing, they're not realizing they're doing it, be influenced by bias. So we metaphorically hoot, and then we need some way to debias, and we need tools and techniques to do that. But which tools and techniques are you going to know? Now, some of you might already know some debiasing techniques, but I researched many. I actually stopped at 27. But a lot of them, it felt like, were a bit too much of an investment that most organizations were willing to pay. So I set some guardrails. I said, these tools and techniques have to be simple, practical, and effective. In other words, the most effective techniques that can be implemented with the least amount of effort. In the book, I've set out six. Some of them I've curated, and others I've actually simplified further. I'm not sure if I'm going to mean anything to you, but those are the names of them. Now, I'm not going to have time to go through all of them today, but, you know, I'm going to quickly run through the simplest and the diagnostics technique today, and I'll use those two case studies we just spoke about. So if we just look at the simplest one, it came about because I challenged myself to answer, what would I do if I could do only one thing to debias with the least amount of effort? And my answer is just ask one simple question in a conversation, or put it on an agenda or put it in the report. And the question is, what if we are wrong? The question serves as a contrary technique and it broadens thinking. It encourages people to consider the possibility that they may have actually jumped to conclusions, they may have made incorrect assumptions, and they may have discounted evidence that didn't support their initial decision. But obviously they have to keep an open mind when doing all of that. If they have a closed mind, none of that's going to happen. It forces people to assume the decision's wrong, and it gives them permission to challenge the consensus. Its simplicity is its strength. So what is that going to look like, you know, in practice? Let's go back to that Deepwater Horizon study. Now, there was a report to the U.S. president, which we spoke about, and in it, they speak about the fact that after those that failed test and then the successful alternative test, the well site leaders and the crew had a conversation, and they declared the test a success, and they decided to move on to that next step. Now, let's imagine that BP had decided to bring in the idea of a hoot before this, and they decided to bring it in, let's say, to the abandonment process. And knowing how decisions get made in rigs, they decided they were going to hoot with the simplest technique. So they got to the point where they made the decision they were going to move on. And at that point, one of the well site leaders may have said, right, next thing we have to do is we have to hoot. And he might have reminded them by saying, we're going to have to challenge ourselves. Keep an open mind on this one. What if we are wrong? Some brave crew member may have at that point volunteered that the most obvious place may be that they've misinterpreted those failed negative pressure test results. And, you know, the most plausible alternative reason for the negative pressure test might be actually that there's a leak. This may have started a debate. Sure, people had their own opinions. But the well site leader, you know, keeping in mind the implications of getting it wrong and also knowing that he was probably going to have to go and report on this hoot, it may have changed his mind. He may have decided to, you know, go back to head office and, you know, recheck with them. Well, we'll never know. But there can't be any harm in reconsidering such big decisions. So the first technique, you hoot, and then you just use the really simplest way, which is you just ask the question, what if we're wrong? I quickly jump, and I am nearly done. I'm sure I've been speaking for a very long time. Are we okay with the time? Very quickly. All right. I'm going to summarize this one. The diagnostics technique. Let me quickly tell you, it's still very practical, but it does require a little bit more investment. Now, if I very quickly explain to you how we make decisions, this is really, really basic. Decisions are choices we're making about predictions we're making in the future. How do we make predictions? We make assumptions about what's going to happen. And how do we make assumptions and predictions? We use information to support it. So, but the problem is that heuristics can lead us to be selective in the information we're using. And so we might make the wrong assumptions and predictions. So this diagnostics tool that was adapted from the technique set out by the U.S. government in how to improve intelligence analysis, which is actually pretty cool. I did simplify it, though, to make it for a non-intelligence gathering. What it's aiming to do is it's aiming to make those underlying information and assumption more transparent, exposing where biases may have led to errors. The technique focuses on validating the accuracy of those key assumptions, predictions, and information. It's used to explore where there's gaps and faulty logic. And in the case of Boeing 737, I'm not going to go into the detail because I'm pretty sure that I'm running late. But let me basically say that it might have called out the fact that they made the assumption, firstly, that the AOA, they was only using one sensor, and number two, that they just assumed that pilots would know what to do if the MCAS failed. It might have resulted in a different answer. Again, we'll never know. So if I just end off. You know, everything I've shared with you today and a lot more is actually sitting in the book. Right now it's in what Nicolette said, the beta version. So I'm just actually just trying to get some feedback right now. I'm only, you know, giving it to a few people to read it right now. I've kept it short and to the point on purpose. People who've read it so far have said it's an easy read, and that matters to me because this is not theoretical. I really want it to be practical, and I really want it to help people in their organizations and in their lives and be useful. So I brought a few copies with me today. I'm sharing them as part of the feedback process before I publish it more widely in a finalized version. If you take a copy, as I've said, the only thing that I ask is that you just give me any feedback. You know, that's very useful. Any comments will help, and I'd really, really appreciate it. So that's my email address there, or you can find it in the book if you take one of the books. And I just want to say that, I mean, I really hope that this pushes you to rethink those big decisions you're making in your organization and that it gives you some practical things to do to help you make and improve decisions. Thank you.
Okay, we've got about 6 minutes for questions. Do you want to go up to the mic? And while you do that, I've got a couple of good ones online from Colin Priest, which we'll start off with. Yeah, go. And I'll start with this question and then you can go. Isn't the 737 MAX problem ultimately caused by the new management team sidelining the engineers from decisions and politicians removing independent oversight? The lesson is that technical people, e.g. aircraft engineers or actuaries, are essential for safety of the public and self-regulation rewards sociopath behaviors.
Oh, wow.
Woo. Business execs can't be trusted with high risk management decisions.
Drop mark. Okay. What I actually say in the book, and you know, there's actually a few things that come up in the book. One of them is, as we said, there's many reasons that, you know, failure happens. It's never one thing. Absolutely. It was definitely an issue where the culture changed. They got bought by McDonnell Douglas, or there was a merger with McDonnell Douglas, but the McDonnell Douglas, you know, management came in and just changed the culture. They went from being an organization that was more about engineering and doing clever things to worrying about their share price. Absolutely, that has to do with it. And absolutely, they ignored, their engineers were telling them things and they were ignoring them. And actually, in my book, one of my key things that I found from my book, there were a few things. Bias is one of them. The fact that there's a you know, multifaceted thing. But one of the other ones is that staff know. Absolutely, those engineers got ignored. And it was part of the problem, for sure, for sure. And I think that if you can change the culture and be open-minded and actually hear from your staff, and have those debates and work out if we're wrong, it definitely would have changed things. But I do appreciate the
factories
yeah.
And technical experts. Do you want to go now?
Yeah, so Colin actually covered pretty much what I was going to ask, but I'll probably expand on that. And so I think the HOOT framework, I think the illustrated is quite useful, but I wonder whether it's potentially a bit too idealized. And I guess it speaks to, I think really the issue is whether or not a robust risk culture exists within the organization. So you mentioned that Boeing was a noted leader, very well respected for its engineering for many, many decades, and really just changed after the McDonnell Douglas merger. So before that, obviously something was happening right. There weren't these big high-profile incidents. So I wonder whether, like, I guess the HOOT process itself already sort of exists, provided you have a healthy risk culture.
I think that's fair. I think you probably do have that. But the problem is, how do you make sure that you have that in every decision? And I think you're probably going to get pockets of people that are like that and do that, you know, without even realizing it. It's just built in them. But I think that you have to have a framework to make sure that everyone does and then brings everyone to the same level. And I agree with you that, you know, It never happened before in Boeing, and they weren't thinking about that. But also, I guess the problem with Boeing before all of this was that they possibly weren't thinking about profits. And so there's always a balance between it. But I just feel like you need to bring everyone to the same level. You can't assume that everyone's going to do this the right thing. You actually have to bring in some level of a framework to make sure that everyone does.
Yeah, and I guess as a follow-on to that, what role do you think boards should play in ensuring, this all happens?
I think boards are actually very key in all of this. I think that they should be looking at decisions that are being made and being questioning these things. You know, what did you use to make this decision? You know, what did you discount? They actually should be asking those kind of hoot questions to really, you know, push at those, you know, those decisions and not just assume that the senior management has done that. And, you know, how do they know how that decision has been made? I think it's worth having a conversation about that. And that's why I think the reporting is so important on those big decisions, really understanding how they actually, you know, kick the tires on their own decisions. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't change the decision itself, but, you know, at least you understand the things they thought about and the risks of it. I think it's also great for risk teams. I know I'm being totally biased here myself, but this is amazing for the risk team because it also, you know, can pinpoint to the risk team where they should be also be looking.
Cool. Thank you.
I mean, I think we all know that in our risk culture results, survey results, it varies by team. So we know about that variation. And the point that Simone has really impressed on me is, you know, people know, your staff know. So, you know, from a board point of view, you kind of looking for a mechanism for, you know, that speaking up, which, you know, if anyone can press the hoot, who could press the hoot? Are there any rules around that in your mind?
So it's interesting. Firstly, just to talk about staff know, that actually, if you read the book, is like, you know, the next stage for me that I really think one thing you can do is start asking yourself those questions, but you really actually want to get the information from your staff on what to ask. They really have that information. And yes, sometimes they can be very in the minutiae and they can give you, you know, very minutiae things, but often they know those really big things. And so a big part of it is, you know, finding out from them. In terms of the, you know, who can hoot, as I say, you don't want to be overusing the hoot. I think you have to put very clear criteria. But if you have the right culture and everyone's open-minded, I don't think there's anything wrong with someone saying, and what if you're wrong, you know? You don't have to say, hoot, I'm going to hoot everyone, I'm hooting now. You could just subtly ask the question, and what if we're wrong? And I can't see in an open culture where, you know, where debate is encouraged what the problem is. You can only get better answers, I think, and better decision-making.
Thank you. A very quick last one, because Colin asked another good question. What if I were wrong is an excellent use case for AI. So I like this because it links back to some of our
good
themes.
Good point. I like it.
We are using a variant of that at UNSW, which is having an AI write a counter argument. Is anyone doing this in real life?
Oh, my God. That is brilliant. I love it. I'm stealing it. Yes, that's a very clever idea. I haven't heard of anyone doing that, but very, very clever. Using AI to ask that question is brilliant, and it's a great way to de-bias decisions if people listen to it.
Okay. Well, thank you. Please give Simone a very warm round of applause. Congratulations. And
anyone
on a first-come, first-served basis, yes, if you'd like a copy of
there
the book.
Sorry, those aren't the only ones. There are four more behind me. So anyone who's willing to read it.
It's going to be like the Hunger Games for actuaries.
I hope it is.
Okay, thanks, everyone. Thank